Thank you. Thank you, Tolan. Now we know. Recording in progress. So I hope that was an enjoyable sit for you all. I do love the chance to have the time to sit together. And over the last month, I think since mid-May, I've sort of been moving us in the directions of working with different elements like space, the element of space, water, earth, in conjunction with the Brahma Viharas, or the divine abodes. And for any of you who have sat retreats at Sphere Rock, you know the dorms are named after these four heart qualities of metta, which is loving kindness, karuna, compassion, mudita, the sympathetic joy, and upekkha, the crown jewel of the heart, which is equanimity. And the last couple of weeks, meandering through the waters of metta and compassion, and I want to stay with that today and explore some more about the richness, the complexities of compassion. And the book that I've been quoting from and totally love, Christina Feldman's Boundless Heart. I think I've referenced it every week for a while now. She has this great line, compassion has an extended family. And I want to talk today about the extended family of compassion. And in addition to the Brahma Viharas, the siblings of compassion and the divine abodes, it's the notion of with these heart qualities, these four heart qualities, there's such a wisdom in the heart. And these four qualities do indeed balance each other. And for this week and next week also, kind of play in the realm of the extended family of compassion. And again, speaking last time, a few times of the blending of metta, the loving kindness and compassion. And with metta, it's not always being loving friendly. Sometimes loving kindness can simply be, not simply, but can be resting in a place of non-aversion, because aversion does come. We don't like certain things. Certain people are challenging. Certain situations are unchallenging. Injustice that we're seeing rampant, there's an aversion that comes up. So how, again, as I was speaking earlier, it's like, how do we make space for all that comes and the parts of ourselves that we may have aversion to as well? Sort of meeting that part of ourselves with as much ease, friendliness as possible. And sometimes it's not possible. So can we meet ourselves with that sense of non-aversion? And compassion has this quality also. Kristen Neff and her beautiful work on self-compassion and how do we work with ourselves being compassionate to include all parts of ourselves, the parts we don't like, the parts that get short-tempered and can rage or get frustrated or that energies, among others. We could be like, I'm a spiritual person. I shouldn't have those. Oh, we do. You know, the personality is the personality. And we have, and our reactivity is there. And this practice, much like water, kind of smooths over the sharpest of stones. This practice can really smooth over our own sharp edges of reactivity, so we can learn to take a breath, to pause. That very act right there is an act of self-compassion. I think it would actually be an act of all four of the Brahma Viharas as a way of, oh, sweetie, can you let the mud settle till the wise action can arise? Letting the body have its response instead of trying to feel like, well, I shouldn't have had that reaction. It's a little bit like I shouldn't have had that thought. It's very hard to control. You know, the mind, I think it's one of the ajans, like the mind is shameless, the things that it thinks. And for us to beat ourselves up for the things that we think, it's like, well, what we can control is how we respond, how we act upon our thoughts, and being able to sit in that place of like, I don't always believe my thoughts. And there can be tremendous freedom in that. And in leaning into this, the idea of self-compassion for all that's here, right? So from Rumi's poem, some of you know probably by heart, the guest house. This being human is a guest house. Every morning, a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all, even if they're a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture. Still, treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes, for they have been sent from as a guide. from beyond. And this, as I like to say, you can open the front door and also open the back door. So there's a sense of moving. Come on in. You don't necessarily have to stay for dinner and keep going. But being able to position ourselves in a place of this too, okay, there's a fearlessness in being able to greet them at the door laughing. Sometimes we can get there and sometimes we can't. Okay, that's part of this self-compassion of, you know what, actually, right now, I don't want that guest coming in. All right, so how do we, what do we need? How do we nourish ourselves? What resources can we pull together so that when the time comes, we can meet them at the door one at a time, perhaps? So one of the ones, family members, I want to stress today is this notion of patience and patience with ourselves primarily. Again, we can have expectations of how we think we should behave or react or respond or all that we should be able to do in a day as women. It's like, get it done. Sometimes and sometimes not. And can we cultivate the capacity to be patient with ourselves in our humanity, our flawedness, our exhaustion, our fatigue, our fears? Making space, welcoming. Okay, this too. And again, this, I do refer to this internally all the time. This, again, our Sangha here, it's vast. Okay. Can we offer something up into the Sangha to be held and alchemized by this group of often 30, 40, 50 women to utilize this in the times in between when we meet as a resource to lean into? How do I work sometimes that there's so much that I can't individually hold in? And I think this is the notion that somehow we should be able to individually hold what all that's happening is what we could phrase would be wrong view. I've been listening to, I think I might have referenced this last week, this great audiobook by Oprah Winfrey and Bruce Perry. Bruce Perry is this really fabulous psychiatrist and PhD. I think he's out of University of Chicago now, but working with developmental trauma and the impact on the brain and what happens. And he and Oprah sort of trade chapters. It's sort of a conversation, but they each have their own pieces. And tremendous vulnerability on the part of Oprah and some of the traumas that she went through. And in one of the pieces, Dr. Perry is speaking about his profound interest in the power of healing within Indigenous cultures, First Nation folks. In Canada, here in the States, are different Native American tribes. He went to Australia. And he was speaking about a time when he went to New Zealand and was visiting with the Maoris, with the elders as healers and trying to learn, like, how do you heal? Because in the West, the dominant culture in the West have our own versions of very medicalized and can be individuated. There's something wrong and wanting to fix, a tendency to fix the symptoms. And he learned in his couple of days with the Maoris that it was very much a collective healing of how we bring ourselves, the community could come together to hold all that was there, that there was a reliance upon rhythm and dance and song and ritual. But most importantly was it being able to come together. We don't really heal alone, isolated. And again, as I mentioned earlier, the hope in this group is that it can be, even in its form as an internet sangha, that it can be a place of refuge because we do need each other. So this idea of suffering with our own challenges in our lives, it's like, we're not wired that way. We're herd animals. And in this coming out of 15 months or so, 16 months of this pandemic, it was very isolating, very harmful to a lot of us on mental health, in addition to other ways. And as we're trying to find our people again, so to speak, how do we do this with it? Noting that the nervous system has really been through a lot in this time of isolation. And is it okay to be someone that, oh, you're too close to me, and all this that the brain is trying to figure out, and it's overwhelming. Dr. Perry also makes the point that there's a line, it's not from him, but somebody else, that the science has given us so much knowledge so quickly, but society has not kept pace in terms of wisdom. Here, we're not a very wise society. And part of it's said that the two wings of the Dharma are compassion and wisdom, that they come together. And patience is one of these pieces that is important in both wisdom and compassion, both to be able to slow down enough to take in though there is that quivering of the heart in response to somebody else's suffering, in terms of wisdom to be able to have that pause so that reactivity isn't the first thing to come out of our mouths. There can be a settling in. Joseph Goldstein says that wisdom doesn't come from the thinking mind. Okay, he doesn't say it like that, but that's what he's pointing to. The thinking mind is not equated with wisdom. It's how we get the heart and the mind and the body all involved in a place of congruence such that that's where the wisdom can come from. But in order to get all this sort of lined up at times, it requires a sense of patience and slowing down. From the Dhammapada, patience is an ocean on account of its depth, a shore on account of its bounding the great ocean of hatred. Patience should be fortified by reflection. All beings are like my own children. When one becomes angry, this is what happens when it's handwritten, my apologies. Who becomes angry over the misdeeds of their own children? Some people might. That's not the point. But that image of patience is like the ocean and like the shores. And that, again, the evocation of the natural world, the expansiveness, the movement of the ocean, the way the waves undulate. Analio, a beautiful scholar and teacher, has spoken about the agitation of the waves and our capacity to drop down 50 yards to below the surface of the agitation. And in that dropping down, there's can be an embodied experience of patience and acceptance and be like, okay, this is the flow of things. And sometimes they're flowing in directions we don't like. Okay. And again, making space for their preferences. Some situations require discernment that we need to take steps to get out of. So patience is very much another sibling or close relative I would include in this is discernment, that in the leaning into the teachings of equanimity or patience, it's not about accepting all situations as the doormat. It's just allowing the reactivity to settle down, slowing down enough to get clear what's actually true. Is what my mind is telling me reliable, or is it a story that I've had about someone or something or about myself that I've carried since somebody told me something when I was six? And being able to parcel out what's the truth, intermix all the entanglements of the causes and conditions and our own traumas and the cultures that we grew up in. Patience can allow us to slow down enough to really investigate. And sometimes that requires phenomenal courage, because at times, for some of us, the last thing we want to do is actually look at all that, because it can bring up so much and there can be so much either impacts, reverberations from traumas, or just sadness and facing loneliness. And what does that do to us? So there's where the self-compassion comes in of like, oh yeah, sweetheart, it's really hard. And being able to bring in the skillful means of when is it time to slow down enough to really investigate and sit with something, and when is it like, nope, what call a friend, the sort of the skillful discernment, the skillful distractions. Where do we go to find relief, to find a place of resource and refuge? Two quotes from Pema Chodron on patience, which I love. Patience is not learned in safety. It is not learned when everything is harmonious and going well. When everything is smooth sailing, who needs patience? If you stay in your room with the door locked and the curtains drawn, everything may seem harmonious. But the minute anything doesn't go your way, you blow up. There's no cultivation of patience when your pattern is just to try to seek harmony and smooth everything out. Patience implies willingness to be alive rather than trying to seek harmony. Right? So nice. Like, yes, life is challenging. We're going to have difficult people in our lives. We're going to be out in the world and things are going to suck. Okay. How do we lean into that of, okay, what can I learn? How can this teacher arise? How can I see what's arising as a teacher to learn more deeply about embodying a sense of patience? She says somewhere else, this is Pema Chodron again, then you can say thank you to all the pointless situations and people who irritate you. This perfection of patience, it can make one's life a vehicle for blessings, right? Because we do get irritated, and there can be sometimes subtle expectation that if we practice a lot and we're dedicated to the Dharma, that we won't get irritated anymore. I don't actually know it. That might be possible, but I haven't met anyone who's had that experience. We are going to get irritated. Okay. The Dalai Lama writes about getting irritated. If he doesn't get enough sleep, he gets irritated. And so being able to just accept, yes, we still are human with all of our ways that we get entangled and tired and grouchy. Okay. Meet them at the door laughing and be like, all right, what can I do? Can I pause here? Check in with myself and notice what's going on. So this is a story that is often shared in Dharma teachings, but I do love it. And it's from Zorba the Creek. I remember one morning when I discovered a cocoon in the back of a tree, just as a butterfly was making a hole in its case and preparing to come out. I waited a while, but it was too long appearing and I was impatient. I bent over it and breathed on it to warm it. I warmed it as quickly as I could, and a miracle began to happen before my eyes, faster than life. The case opened and the butterfly started slowly crawling out. I shall never forget my horror when I saw how its wings were folded back and crumpled. The wretched butterfly tried with its whole trembling body to unfold them. Bending over it, I tried to help with my breath in vain. It needed to be hatched out patiently. The unfolding of the wings should be a gradual process in the sun, and now it's too late. My breath had forced the butterfly to appear all crumpled before its time. It struggled desperately and a few seconds later died in the palm of my hand. That little body, I do believe, is the greatest weight I have on my conscience. I realize today that it's a mortal sin to violate the great laws of nature. We should not hurry. We should not be impatient, but we should confidently obey the external rhythm. And this external rhythm of the natural world, the sun rises, the sun sets, the days get longer, the days get shorter. In this modern time of ours, so many of us are so separated from the natural rhythms, caffeine, coffee, lights. You know, we fight against what might be the natural external rhythms. As a culture here, the dominant culture here in the States, it's really fast, particularly here in the Bay Area. It's too fast. We can't quite keep up. Again, from the book with Bruce Perry, if humans have been on this earth for 250,000 years, 99% of that time we lived in clans of 60 or 100 people. That's kind of what our systems are wired for, is what he's saying. That's not how we live anymore. We're here in the States, a lot of us are isolated, or nuclear families, or we don't have our extended family close by. And the system gets overloaded very easily. And sometimes we pay attention to this and we honor it, and sometimes we don't. Culturally, we're not really encouraged to pay attention to it. Medicate it, distract it, numb out. Again, how can we find moments? We all have what we need to be able to do and get done in the course of a day. This is not although it would be fun to all go on vacation somewhere and retreat from the busyness of our lives. It's more of how can we lean into these tools to make our day-to-day finding places where we can actually take a breath. What's happening? What is my natural rhythm? Is it in sync with, could I allow it to be in sync with the natural world? Maybe, maybe not. Do I even know what the natural rhythm of when are the times in the day when I'm most available for work? When do I need to rest? Can we slow down enough to pay attention to what's actually needed such that I can show up as fully for myself from a place of compassion, self-compassion, and awareness around about the world around me? I'll take a pause there and we'll slide into an exercise. I'm going to invite you to close your eyes. And just to check in how these words may or may not be landing. And first, just check in how the word patience resonates. Some of us growing up might have been told, like, don't be impatient, stand in line. And this form of patience, It's different. This is more of an expansive, more like, again, that sense of the ocean. You know, the line of see, this is more equanimity, but it's a flavor of patience, like seeing the world through grandmother's eyes. You've seen it all, lifetimes. And if we think of that boy in the story who blew on the cocoon, forcing that butterfly too quickly out of its chrysalis, to consider, is there any way in our own life with internally to ourselves, or maybe with those that we love, that we're kind of blowing on the chrysalis? Hurry up. Or that breath may not have the energy of hurry up, but it may have an exhalation of expectation, of a demand, however loving or well-intentioned it may be, a push against a natural pacing. Is there a way that we're pushing ourselves in a way that may be harmful, subtly, energetically? If we think about the arc of a day or the arc of a week, are there times we get caught up in the hurry, hurry to ourselves, to those around us? And it can have the form of action out in the world, hurry, hurry, but also internally, like, why haven't I figured this out yet? Or why haven't I been able to make this decision yet? Pushing ourselves to go faster than we're actually able to go. And what might it be like to be able to relax into? What would the natural pacing be? What would it be like to allow for there to be a natural unfolding rather than the controlled hurry up? John O'Donohue, again, I'd like to live as the river does, surprised by its own unfolding. We can get caught up in meddling with ourselves. Do more, go faster, you're not enough. Why haven't you done this? What are you doing? Don't you know? Why don't you know? What would it be like to lean back into an embodied sense of there is enough time. I trust the pacing here. I can trust my own pacing. It may not match up with another's expectations. It may not even line up with my own expectations that I may have inherited from somebody else. But beginning to cultivate this muscle that says, I trust my own pacing. Trust my own unfolding of my own life. And what does that feel like to imagine into? And what might it be like to move in the world from that place of honoring with compassion for oneself, for others? Feeling supported and buoyed by a sense of patience and gentleness. Okay. This too, welcome and entertain them all. Stay connected to our own goodness, our own hearts, to be able to welcome, entertain them all, and show those who shouldn't stay the back door when it's time. Again, trusting ourselves. and leaning into that expansive nature of patience and compassion. So thank you all for coming with me on that, and would love to shift gears and open up the Zoom room for people would like to share what came up in response to what I shared, if you have any practice questions, and would just ask in the course of sharing that you just stay with your own experience and to the extent possible, not comment on what other people say, because we might not always quite understand where that person's coming from.